Welcome to the lighter side of the dark side. It's your weekly freak show here on Renegade Radio and all podcast catchers, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, YouTube, everywhere you're listening to us and watching us. It's the Dark Mark Show. I am Dark Mark, the goth comedian. And as some people know, I've got my hands full doing something in life other than art, and it's been taking up my time. So I haven't posted podcasts every week and had the regular show. So what I've been doing is I've been getting friends over to discuss movies. And the first one was Alien vs. Predator, which we discussed with Nicole Six. The second was Jason Takes Manhattan, which we discussed with Hannah Bach and a horror director, Dustin Ferguson. And in the great tradition of Alien vs. Predator and Jason Takes Manhattan, we're actually going to be discussing actually a movie that one of my favorite movies that I went and saw last month with this person. You know them. They have been on the show before. So many talents, so many things. Dancer, psychic, comedian, model. What else do you do? You do so many things. A multimedia artist. It's Elle Font.
Yes. Hi.
What did I leave out, Elle?
No, you covered it. I was about to say multimedia artist, but you got that too. So
right, right.
And I recently shot a music video just because I was asked to. So, no, I did not. I have to be fair. I did not direct it. There was already direction coming from someone else. But I did do the cinematography. So
okay, cinematographer.
Yeah.
comedian, dancer, actress, mom, actor. Excuse me. So. I had to get that one out of the way so it won't happen again the rest of the show. Anyway, so we're going to talk Lost Highway. Now, before we do, I got to tell you something. I really have to wake up. It's 8 o'clock, and it's about time for me to go to bed. But I'm going to stay up for the show because of this. Raise energy drink, my favorite energy drink. It's the best. This is the Galaxy Burst. This tastes like Fruity Pebbles. And the best part of it, zero calories. Zero carbs, zero crash, and it's delicious. It'll keep you up. Go to the description in your podcast catcher or on YouTube, or you're catching us on YouTube, and you get 15% off a case. 15% off the case of the best energy drink you can't find in 7-Elevens. Can't find it in stores. Zero calories, zero carbs, zero crash, zero dyes. Delicious taste, and it'll keep you up all night. So, which, yeah, I guess maybe a couple characters in this movie probably could use it. Now, it was about in August, you had said something out that you wanted to see The Lost Highway. It's a 25th year anniversary, so they put out the 4K version in theaters. Now, what prompted you? Because I'll start off because we were talking after the movie, and I said, I wanted you to come on and talk to me about it. And you said, well, I don't know, because I'm not a big David Lynch super fan.
Well, okay, I want to be clear. I am a fan of David Lynch's. I just felt that kind of like I'm not the world's biggest David Lynch expert. And, you know, you and I live in LA, and there are a lot of like cinema aficionados here, you know, and like my focus has been in a lot of artistic places. And I enjoy going to the movies. And like I said, I love David Lynch's work. It's definitely inspiring. And I'm a huge fan. But I guess I was kind of surprised that you asked me, because I was like, all right, like I'm not necessarily the person who wears David Lynch super fan on my sleeve. But at the same time, there's definitely like a Venn diagram within David Lynch's work of stuff I like the fact that, you know, Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails helped to produce the soundtrack and everything like that and curate the soundtrack. And it's an amazing soundtrack. It's one of my all-time favorite picks for movie soundtracks, in my opinion.
I would go along with that. We're going to talk about that. Do I fit the Venn diagram of a David Lynch superfan?
Probably. I mean, I guess I could say, like, I watched the original Twin Peaks not when it was on, because I was just a tiny little bit too young.
Right.
But when it came to Netflix, I believe. And so I watched the original. I think I've seen the Fire Walk With Me movie, if I'm not mistaken. I have not seen the recent Twin Peaks season.
Well, we're going to talk about all that, but I have seen every David Lynch movie. I don't know if I qualify as a super fan, but I've seen it, except for The Straight Story. I've seen them
all. Oh, I have a story about that.
Oh, please.
So, funny story. that same night that you and I went to see Lost Highway together, mm-hmm. I peripherally kind of invited another friend of mine along, because I know he's into David Lynch's stuff. And it was that evening, just a few weeks ago, like sometime in August, that mm-hmm. he told me about the movie Straight Story.
Right.
And that it existed, and that David Lynch had tried to like put together some PG rated movie for Disney.
And it was actually G-rated, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. And I was like, this is a joke, right? Like, you're making fun of me right now because you don't think I know about David Lynch movies. And he was like, no, this is real. It's on Disney Plus.
Mm-hmm.
So shortly thereafter, my partner and I tried to watch Straight Story. Unfortunately, we did not make it all the way through. I think we got through like roughly 30 minutes. The beginning definitely kind of dragged.
Okay.
It was not an engaging watch. And like, for the attention span that I know kids have nowadays,
right?
I'm like, okay, I don't know that this was for kids. I think this might have been for people coming down off drugs in the 90s.
Well, I don't think it's for kids or people coming off drugs either. I think it's for older audiences, because if I recall, maybe? It's about an older man who drives. It's a true story, apparently.
Yeah.
Drives a tractor across country to see his brother who's dying. And Richard Farnsworth, the star, was nominated for an Oscar. And apparently, I hear it's really good, but I don't know if, we did see I was going to say, I don't know if people have the attention span for Lost Highway these days, but then again, mm-hmm. we were in a theater largely with millennials, and we'll talk about some of their reaction, but no, I'm glad, because it literally is one of my favorite movies. It's my favorite David Lynch movie. I know you prefer Blue Velvet, and that's definitely up there. You know, I got to be honest. I'm going to piss off all the David Lynch super fans right off the bat and declare myself not the super fan, because I've got to be honest. I like scenes of Eraserhead, but I don't like it as a movie.
I have never gotten around to seeing that one, so unfortunately, I can't.
It's a rough one. Yeah, okay. I mean, he filmed it over several years,
mm-hmm.
and like I say, there are scenes that are really good. But there's no story, and I mean, there is a story, but it doesn't hold together, in my opinion. But there are some scenes that are great. I do like The Elephant Man, which is his first studio movie. I think that's really good.
I've heard good things about that one for sure. Yeah,
but that's even though that's mainstream, there's some weird surreal touches to that. But the performances are great. Dune sucks. Blue Velvet's great.
Yeah, actually, that's another thing. I don't think I've ever made it 100% of the way through Dune.
That's another rough one.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, I saw the new Dune, and I wasn't that engaged with that one either. I mean, it's the story, and I just don't think I responded to the story. I remember when I was a kid, I tried to read Dune, and so I heard great things, and I couldn't. Yeah, it wasn't for me.
I know a lot of people who enjoyed the books of Dune, and actually, because of the people I knew who loved the books of Dune so much, because they talked it up so much, and they were like, oh, you have to see the movie, you have to see the movie. And then I watched the movie, I was like, don't totally see what the big deal is about, but okay.
I'm with you. I don't see the big deal. I mean, I understand how Star Wars was influenced by it and other things, but but that doesn't mean it itself is great. But if people like it, that's fine. David Lynch's Dune sucks, even by his estimation. But the good thing about that is he really, from that, he started his real glorious period, which was Blue Velvet, which is a great movie. I can watch that scene with Dean Stockwell singing on a loop. I love that whole thing. Then Twin Peaks was the big, I mean, that's where he really entered the zeitgeist. And I was really young when that came out, but I do remember my mom watching it. I do remember, like, I was a kid, but I remember the little person coming out in the third episode, and it was like the weirdest thing ever. But it seemed like it's a long time ago, but if I recall, people just, it was a sensation like the first 3 weeks. And it's not like now where they, you know, everybody binge watches everything. You had to wait a week, and I think people tuned out after 3 or 4 weeks. They just got too weird for them.
Yeah, weirdly enough, it's like I said, I never watched it when it was like live in real time being broadcast. But my mom used to go visit this like elderly Romanian professor in like Garden Grove, and she would bring me along with her, and he would have like these stacks of TV guides.
Right.
That he had in his apartment. And so my pastime, because this was like pre-cell phones, tablets, obviously, but my pastime,
that's what we had to do was TV Guide.
Right. My pastime while she was visiting with him was reading TV guides. And like every TV guide was just rabid about Twin Peaks this, Twin Peaks that. That's what I remember from that time period.
And Twin Peaks was very influential on a lot of things, obviously on style. Which is a lot of retro style, but I mean, all the shows that came out of it, you know, Northern Exposure, Picket Fences, and a miniseries Wild Palms, which I'll get to a little later on because there's some weird stuff going on. But and then he did Wild at Heart, which I don't like. I don't like that. But it's Nicolas Cage. I'm not a big. If it's Nicolas Cage, he stops the movie and distracts every time I watch it. But
yeah,
there are scenes in there that are great. I think William Dafoe, Crispin Glover, Sherilyn Fenn, like, are really good, but they're not the main characters. So.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Are you too wild at heart?
No, I don't think I've ever seen it. I'm trying to like scan my brain. That's one of those. It was like a snippet on TV or in the background of something, but I definitely have not like sat down and watched it.
Nicolas Cage doing a bad Elvis imitation and Laura Dern doing a bad Marilyn Monroe imitation. And
oh, wow. Yeah,
it's pretty wild. And I haven't seen it in a long time, but every time I watch it, like every good scene, there's a horrible scene afterwards and doesn't. But it was written by, it's based on a novel by Barry Gifford, who co-wrote Lost Highway.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he did Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, which in a weird way, I actually prefer to the series, and it's completely different.
Yeah,
I find that a very powerful movie. You've never seen that movie?
I remember. I think I watched it at some point, but it was one of those things where I watched it, I think, at the tail end, like after I had watched the original, all of the original Twin Peaks, all the way through. So I don't remember a lot of specifics about it, about that particular one, but I do remember enjoying it.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I just remembered like it definitely was like more of a standalone plot line versus the ongoing shtick with Laura Palmer. And
well, he basically made a pretty bold move, which was that he cut out a lot of the wacky characters and really focused on this incestuous relationship. I mean, it's a movie about the effects of incest on a young lady, with all the surrealism and weird touches. But that's basically somebody who's just been shattered by that. And to me, that's a really powerful movie. And I think Cheryl Lee gives a great performance. And I It just, I think I saw the movie before I saw the show, for the most part. Like I said, when I was a kid, it was on in the background, but I saw it before I actually binge watched the show. And a lot of people, I mean, people hated it. Horrible reviews, no box office. Quentin Tarantino said it was like the worst thing he's ever seen. Like, he was a pariah because of that. And then it took him 5 years to make another movie, and this movie is the one we're discussing now. And then he's only made two movies since, which was Mulholland Drive, which is very similar to Lost Highway. Most people find it superior to Lost Highway. I like Highway better.
Yeah.
And Inland Empire, which is that's a crazy one to get to. Once again,
was Inland Empire a series?
No, it was a standalone 3-hour movie. I saw that in the movie theater in 2006, and I took a date, and I'm not sure if she was she wanted to be with me. She really didn't want to see the movie, but it's a weird movie because it was him doing all digital, and some of the digital looks really bad, like really like camcorder, like 80s camcorder quality, and some of it is lit and looks amazing. And he actually, in the middle of the movie, he put some scenes of his rabbits TV, a little web series that he had on online, where he had people dressed up in rabbit heads, and it was so that's interspersed in the movie.
That is so David Lynch.
Laura Dern plays like three different parts, or does she? And then there's a whole subplot in Poland, in Polish, which is shot amazingly. But, you know, some of the, I mean, they have like bad close ups of people like this, and it's not even Zoom quality. It's like horrible quality. It's really weird. But it's weird for the sake of weird. And he even says, like, he says that Mulholland Drive and Lost Highway, there is a, you know, it's open to interpretation, and you know, it's designed to be. But Inland Empire, he even says, look, we were just kind of making it up. And so there's like, you know, they just like threw a bunch of stuff together, and it's, I guess, you know, I'm sure there's people online that have theories that make sense, but it doesn't make sense.
So Inland Empire was Lynch's Because I Can movie.
It was, yeah, it was the, Mulholland Drive was a big hit. I could do whatever I want. But basically he was just like, he had friends over, and he would like, you know, he had like his little, I guess, he would just write out some certain scenes and have them perform, and Laura Dern would come over. And, you know, and just all these people that he's worked with would come over, and he would do these scenes and then just kind of cobble them together. I think if I had to guess, I think he was working on something, and the whole Polish thing was a real movie. And then he kind of, I don't know, like the whole thing starts. William Macy has one scene where he's an announcer of a talk show.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never in the movie again. Jeremy Irons has like two scenes and he's never in the movie again. It's like, it's so weird.
Wow.
Like literally the William H. Macy, his whole scene is like, and everybody welcome to the show. And you never see him again.
That's so weird. Weird. It so sounds weird. Like a cut up, like a collage.
It really is. And how it relates to Lost Highways, there's a scene, and this is probably one of the, maybe the best scene in the movie, is they're rehearsing. And Laura Dern sees these figures in the background. And then later on in the movie, you see it from her perspective, and she's one of the figures, she's the figure in the back. So it's a Mobius strip that comes back around. So anyway, all of that, we're going to talk about Lost Highway. Now, had you seen it in a theater before?
That's a good question. I honestly,
you would have been very,
I can't
young,
remember, yeah, I would have been in high school. I think I actually did make it out to go to a theater and see it. It would have, I think it was like an art house type thing,
right?
At the time it was a little bit limited release. But I feel like I did initially see it in the theater.
And kids, those were the days, because I saw it in the theater too. And I was, between high school and college. I know I was 17, so I don't know if I was in high school or college, but I know like there were, you know, a lot. I would go to independent movies all the time. I wish there were still independent movies out instead of superhero movies now. Because it's like, it was so great. It's just some were good, some were bad, but they were all fairly interesting.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But, you know, I was even looking into seeing Clerks 3 because I remember I have fond memories of seeing Clerks and Clerks in 2 in the theater. And then they have like a limited engagement. You got to pay $28. I'm like, oh, no, thanks. I'll wait for it to come on streaming. But anyway, I remember distinctly seeing this and just being blown away. And it's taken me years and years and years to come up with an interpretation. And I don't know if you want to save the interpretations for the end or you want to do it now. Like, what is your interpretation? What happens?
That's up to you. So I will admit that I just, like, after you and I went to the movie theater to see it, I rewatched it one more time.
Right.
Just to kind of, like, watch it back to back with itself.
Right.
I feel that it's very much a loop.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of like how you were saying that I think it was Inland Empire was sort of a loop, but it's very much a loop. I jokingly said to my partner that between, I think his name is Peter, Fred, and Mr. Eddie,
right.
It's a fuckboy at 3 stages of his life.
See, I never thought it, because I was thinking like maybe
the surface reading. I think if you're actually trying to find something linear in the plot, I think that the mystery man, aka Robert Blake, the actor, is really kind of pulling the strings.
Mm-hmm.
With all of these characters. So part of it is that it's a movie about like creating characters and like making performance. And the Mystery Man is very much that.
Mystery Man is very goth, by the way. I like to use him as inspiration for my appearances when I do my act, but you know, with the makeup, but he's very goth.
Yeah, he is. And basically I think that Fred somehow like potentially, and I need to credit my partner Rust for like offering his view on this, and we sort of had a big back and forth about it, but at some point in time I feel like Fred, the Bill Pullman character,
mm-hmm.
is somehow dissociated and is placed into like Peter, I think the character's name is Peter, the younger guy,
right,
yeah,
who's never seen again, really. I've never seen another movie again, but
I think he's sort of like displaced into Pete's timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And then like I personally think that Alice, aka Renee, basically like the only substantial feminine character in the movie,
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Eddie are like bait for that other character, Fred / Pete, to like set to like engage with him. And then like when things don't go particularly right, Mystery Man like starts to get rid of the bait character. Is like that there's that point near the end where Alice just kind of disappears and it's only Renee as the main feminine character. And then there's also the point at the end where like I can say spoilers for the movie. Because we're talking about the movie, but there's also the part at the end where they finally kill off Mr. Eddie,
mm-hmm.
aka Dick LaRance.
Dick LaRance. Dick LaRance is dead.
Yeah. So I feel like those characters, Mr. Eddie, aka Dick LaRance, and the Alice Renee character are like bait. Like they're not quite NPCs, but they're like character bait for like the Fred Pete character to like try to have conflict with. Like it's like the more I think about it, the more it's like improv comedy, right. Improv performance prompts.
They're playing freeze tag.
Right. like it's something like that. Like basically they're sort of the givers of action in addition to like the mystery man kind of playing God. Mm-hmm. My partner also suggested that like there could be a vague theory that the mystery man is specifically some kind of vampire, because there's a lot of tableau of like the various dead characters like covered in blood, or when there's that kind of tableau of I think it's towards the beginning with Renee's like body looking all mutilated and murdered and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, it could be argued that it's not necessarily just that like Mystery Man is some kind of trope to represent the movie director, but that he is potentially vaguely like some type of like menacing vampiric creature. Which, if you're gonna make a comment on like directors and people in power in Hollywood, mm-hmm. like that's still kind of tracked. Like I could see David Lynch maybe being like, hey, get it? Like about well, all that kind of thing.
That's kudos to us for these interpretations. And this is what's great about the movie, it's 25 years later. Nobody really knows.
Yeah.
Sorry
to interrupt, but I know like after you and I got out of the movie theater a few weeks ago, you and I chatted about it. And like at that time, my theory was a little less intricate than what I just said. My theory was just that Fred, the Bill Pullman character, was a murderer and he experienced a very complex dissociation, right. Where at some point in time when he was on death row, he like dissociated and thought he was this young man basically, but that was his sort of like mental escape from his imprisonment like situation. And basically kind of like the second half of a movie is basically like just his dissociation from his given situation.
Which David Lynch has actually said it is a psychogenic fugue, or also known as a dissociative fugue. And
okay, good. So
you were right the first time. But I mean, that's my interpretation, although it doesn't explain everything. Now, you know, things that aren't really explained are, and I've heard other theories on this, in that, remember the gruesome scene where the doctor, who kind of resembles Dr. Mengele in the way he does it, throws down some sleeping pills to him,
mm-hmm.
and then he'll sleep now. You know, the theory is, okay, that's when the dream starts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then he becomes, and then I was thinking about it, I'm like, is Balthazar Getty his younger self? Was that him when he was a young man? And or Gary Busey, is Gary Busey's father? Mm-hmm. And then I never even thought about Mr. Eddie being the old man that he will be or he never will be. Although it seems unlikely that he would go from being a saxophonist to a mafia don, but or whatever Mr. Eddie.
Right. Well, I guess more abstractly, I was thinking of that part of it as being like, when you go back to my commentary about like a lot of it is very like wink, wink, nudge, nudge from David Lynch about, oh, hey, aren't directors assholes? Like, aren't, you know, powerful, aren't writers assholes, because we like put all our characters through this stuff, mm-hmm. you know? If you look at it from that perspective, like I said, it's more that these are like, that's more talking about the actual act of character creating and looking at the fact that like there's only a limited number of things to select with. Like there's essentially like, or to select from, excuse me. So there's essentially like three major types of men and like maybe two types of like women feminine characters, right? There's like slutty, sexy, femme fatale, and then there's like kind of girl next door-ish.
It's the eternal Betty Veronica.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, and, is Alice ever real? That's the other thing, because you see a picture with both of them, and then at the end, you just see her.
Right. Like, that's a great question. I don't have a theory either way on that one.
And going with your director theory, by the way, I saw a YouTube video where somebody, and I never even thought of this because it's, you know, we're talking 90s forgotten media, but people said that this is David Lynch getting back at Oliver Stone, because Oliver Stone produced the TV miniseries Wild Palms, which was very, very similar to Twin Peaks and has Robert Loggia in it, who plays Dick Laurent, Mr. Eddy, and has a couple scenes that are very similar. Also cast Balthazar Getty, who was in Natural Born Killers, who played a mechanic in Natural Born Killers, plays a mechanic in this movie. And except for the Twin Peaks, new Twin Peaks, I've never seen him in any other movie or TV show. I know he's been in some, but I've never seen
him. Interesting.
So, and then also there's a scene in Natural Born Killers, which I like too, where Juliette Lewis is like, "You want me? Do you want me?" And then at the end, she's like, you know, he says, "I want you, I want you." Now, that doesn't explain the whole movie, but it may explain some scenes. But it's weird to think that so maybe Robert Blake is supposed to be Oliver Stone. I don't know. It's weird to think that David Lynch would be like, yeah, I'm gonna write a whole movie just to get back at Oliver Stone because he made a miniseries that ripped me off. But who knows?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it wasn't so much like Lynch trying to be petty to Oliver Stone as like, hey, this is kind of like in the style of, or like riffing on.
People have said that it's riffing on Tarantino too, because
I could totally see that. Yeah.
Basically, I'll make my own Pulp Fiction and make it non-linear, make it better.
Right.
Which don't tell anybody, but I actually think Lost Highway is better than Pulp Fiction. But that's just
I mean, if we are going,
and I like Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, if we're going literal on that comparison, and that was actually the intent, like then Lynch bested Tarantino on that one. I agree.
I would think, in my opinion, but not to the critics. Matter of fact, Siskel and Ebert famously gave it 2 thumbs down, and on the poster, they put 2 thumbs down. Another good reason to see Lost Highway.
Whatever, anti-goth bias.
Yes. So it's a very gothy movie. And of course, the other theme is that David Lynch has also said that he was very obsessed with the OJ trial, which everybody in America was, except for me at the time. I remember being sick of it at the time. So the best thing that the OJ trial got us was Lost Highway. The worst thing, probably the Kardashians. But, he said that what was fascinating to him was that, you know, this OJ, in his opinion, killed his wife. And he has suppressed it so much that he doesn't even think he did it. And honestly, what would always bother, there's a couple of things that bother me. And we talked about it after the movie, is that every white person thinks he's guilty. Every black person thinks he's innocent. That always bothered me. And I remember I've broken up fights because of it in all the years since. The other thing that's,
you and I finally talked about why that is, because it took me only until like the past decade to understand why that was the case. You know, even though, yes, OJ was a wealthy and powerful black man, like I can understand why, you know, your average black person, and of course, not everybody has the same opinion or is a monolith, but like, I now understand with all of the bias in policing and corruption in the LAPD and all of that. I now understand why that is the case, what you described, that a lot of Black people did think he was innocent.
Well, and this, I mean, and I don't want to, I really don't want to get into the OJ trial, but the police, whether you think he's guilty or not, admittedly planted evidence, one. Two, what I've always found odd about the case, and I've talked about this to Black and white people, and nobody has an answer to this, they never, ever considered another suspect. His son, his best friend, and Marcus Allen, who had an affair with Nicole, all fit the same description. They all drive the same exact car. And I just recently watched a documentary, which was interesting, and it could be bullshit, it could not be, but it was interesting and laid out the case that OJ ordered her murder and actually named the guy that they said committed the murder as a white guy who was in jail, and he confessed to it on his deathbed. Like, he hired a hitman. The reason that there was some blood on him was because he was there, but he didn't actually do it, which is plausible. But I don't know. I don't know enough about it. I don't know all the evidence, and I didn't follow it. I was sick of everybody. It's like today. Everybody talks about Trump 24 hours a day. Everybody's talking to OJ 24 hours a day back then. Right. And it's like, there's other things going on. There's more interesting things to talk about, like Lost Highway.
Exactly.
And the ironic thing about the movie is the next big celebrity that had a murder trial was Robert Blake, which you were not aware of this.
I was totally ignorant about that. And yeah, what's interesting is, like, when you told me that as we were coming out of the movie, I was not aware of that. But what's interesting is that in my head, I had mixed up Robert Blake and his trial, which apparently occurred like through most of the 2000s, with somebody pretty high profile who was a murderer and was actually convicted in criminal court.
Spectre?
No, somebody who had a really high profile case that like began during the pandemic and was like being broadcast high profile during the pandemic. I don't remember who it was.
But yeah, so that's the ultimate irony. Oh, there's Robert Blake never did a movie again. Obviously, he couldn't get a movie now, but then there was still like 5 or 10 years after this movie. I shouldn't say this. And also the theory is that he could be a vampire. He could be a director. I've also heard say he was pure evil. That's why he could be at two places at once.
Mm-hmm.
He was at the guy's party that was the porn producer, and he was also at his house because he's pure evil.
Right.
But his performance gave me chills. It still gives me chills every time I see it. Just every time he's on screen and starts talking, it's like, ooh.
Oh, yeah. It's very eerie. And I mean, again, what you just described with him being in two places at once, because I considered that too. For me, that was more just like, ha, ha, ha. To me, that was more supporting like the ha, ha, I'm the director. I'm omnipotent. Like, I can be anywhere my characters are because I can, because I made them. Like, you're literally God, you know? So
yeah, apparently, and David Lynch was a fan of his acting. He was, he's a guy that's before our time, but Beretta in the 70s. He was a big star. He apparently, in Cold Blood, which I've read the book, I've never seen the movie, apparently he's amazing in. And I remember when I was a kid, he played Jimmy Hoffa in a TV movie. And I've seen Jack Nicholson and Al Pacino play Jimmy Hoffa since, and I thought he was better. But his performance is creepy, but it's like doubly creepy now that he's like, he could be a murderer. Although I looked into the case and, there's no smoking gun, but there was gun residue on his hands. And he went into the restaurant to get his gun, which is a weird defense.
Yeah,
but
that is the weirdest defense I've heard.
But like, how he got off apparently is that they said that there was another gun that ballistics matched to the bullets, and that wasn't his gun. So I don't know. He also had motive because apparently they were about to get a divorce, and she got pregnant when he didn't want her to. All sorts of things. So I don't want to get into it, but David Lynch also says his favorite scene in the movie, which is kind of laughable, kind of not. It's kind of creepy and laughable at the same time, is when Patricia Arquette turns around and it's got Robert Blake's face on her body.
Yeah. And that's like a blink and you'll miss it moment too.
Oh no, I notice it every time.
Yeah.
So it was his last movie. It's Richard Pryor's last movie. Obviously, he was on his last legs. And Jack Nance, who played Eraserhead, was the old guy in the garage with the mustache who was turning off the radio. It was his last movie.
Interesting.
He died in the weirdest way because apparently somebody noticed he had a black eye one day. He's like, oh, I got in a fight at a donut shop. And then the next day they found him dead, like just an aneurysm. So
wow.
Very strange. But he was in every David Lynch movie until he died. So, and then they brought him back in flashbacks for the Twin Peaks miniseries. But Bill Pullman is an actor I liked a lot. He's very subdued in this movie because I've seen him go really crazy in movies. But I think he's good in the movie, and I've always liked him. Except for Spaceballs. He just sort of doesn't register in Spaceballs. But Serpent and the Rainbow and other things. And a movie that was directed by David Lynch's daughter, Surveillance, he's really good in. But he was an independent. This is coming off an Independence Day, so that he was the big star. I probably got the big movie financed.
Right.
What do you think of Bill Pullman?
I like him as an actor also. Yeah, I couldn't recall a lot of stuff that he was in aside from Independence Day, but that was randomly a movie at the time that I saw in the theater a bunch of times in a row, just because I think it came out like the summer between middle and high school, and it was like bored teenager syndrome. And so like me and my friends,
Jeff Goldblum's in it.
Yeah. Me and my friends just kind of like stayed in the theater and like watched it a few times, like back to back. I can't remember, but
huge hit.
Yeah. I definitely like him as an actor.
This was kind of the peak of his popularity, and Independence Day, and, he was in that Sandra Bullock movie. And then he was also the year before this movie, I think he was in a movie with Ellen DeGeneres' big movie, Mr. Wrong, which prompted every hack comedian to, of course she's Mr. Wrong, she's a lesbian, you know, that kind of thing. So, which I've never seen. But
God. Yeah. No, I didn't see that. Like, yeah, I remember him at the time just kind of being in a lot of movies of seemed like different types of genres.
And he pops around. Yeah. I mean, when you go from Spaceballs to Serpent in a Rainbow to Independence Day to Lost Highway, you're bouncing around.
Yeah. And of course, I'm a huge fan of the movie Spaceballs. So, like,
are you really?
He could have just rolled out of bed and done that movie, and that would have been fine. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
I used to be able to quote it from like at least 50% of that movie.
I totally dissed him in Spaceballs, but you liked him.
Yeah, he was a little bit of like a straight man in Spaceballs, right?
Yeah, he was like too much of a straight man for my taste.
Yeah.
But While You Were Sleeping was a big hit. He was in Casper. I forgot that. Casper. He's in Casper. I'm looking through his it's sort of downhill from there. This was kind of his peak was the mid. You know, 93, he was in Summersby, Sleepless in Seattle, which I've never seen, Malice, Mr. Jones, The Favor, Wyatt Earp, While You Were Sleeping, Casper, Mr. Wrong, Independence Day, Lost Highway, and it kind of goes down from there. But Patricia Arquette, also big mid-90s, and this was at her peak. But she was in Nightmare on Elm Street 3. We all liked that. She was... And then she kind of fluttered around. And True Romance was a big breakthrough to me. And then she was in Ed Wood. True Romance, she's great. Ed Wood, she's great. And Flirting with Disaster, she was great. Lost Highway. And then Stigmata was a big hit. And then she was in Little Nicky with Adam Sandler? Huh, okay. I don't remember that. But and then she kind of, honestly, sort of floundered until Boyhood won her the Oscar. But I've always liked her.
Yeah, I mean, she's great and like very much like awesome sex symbol in this movie.
Patricia Arquette always has these heels on, these huge heels.
Mm-hmm.
Even when she wakes up in the morning and gets the paper, she's got these huge clunky heels on.
Mm-hmm.
Is that his imagination idealizing her, or is it she just likes big clunky heels? And she's a short actress, I would imagine. And that's probably the practical reason for wearing it.
Yeah, that one's hard to say, but that kind of, that goes back to my theory a little bit of like, there are only so many types of like feminine and masculine characters in this movie. And that one female type is just very sex symbol, very high femme, you know.
It's weird in 2022 to see this much nudity in a movie. Sex and nudity.
I think I remember talking about that with my partner when we rewatched it recently. It was like, it is kind of verging on the gratuitous. Yeah, it's like, all right, like.
There's some slow motion booby action.
And, yeah. It's very indulgent in that. But, you know, at the same time, like, I support the normalizing of human bodies. Like, I think, yeah, but it is coming from an interesting place. And when it's kind of a male director, it's, you always have to wonder a little bit. But yeah, I guess you're right. Like,
it's
unusual.
It's not unusual to see it at home, HBO, Showtime, Game of Thrones. You see sex right. all the time. But to see it up on the screen, it used to be the norm. I mean, I guess, you know, in the 60s, when the Hays Code went out, just there was nudity, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s a little bit, and it just kind of stopped.
Right. Like, remember when, like, even 80s movies that were just R-rated had, like, gratuitous, like, toplessness?
PG movies had gratuitous toplessness.
Yeah.
And then, like, I remember, like, Basic Instinct, everybody loved it. I mean, it's just crazy stuff. And then I just kind of phased out. I don't know. But it was weird because, so I know people tittered at some of the nudity and sex.
Yeah.
Some of these crazy kids these days.
Yeah, I know. These kids are more uptight than we were.
they are. But anyway, my favorite Arquette, although I did meet Alexis and she was very nice, but Patricia Arquette, as far as acting, is my favorite.
Yeah. I definitely heard of all those movies you mentioned, and I didn't get around to seeing a whole lot of them, but some of them were like heavy hitters, and I remember.
Never saw True Romance?
No, unfortunately, I haven't. Believe it or not.
You should. It's really good, but I don't know. Yeah, I haven't seen it in a while. I don't know.
I believe I saw most, if not all, of Ed Wood. But it's one of those weird things.
That's another one, too.
Like, that, I watched that during, like, a fairly, like, stonery part of my early 20s. And I think it was one of those things where it was, like, either I was watching part of it, and then the person, probably my partner at the time, who I was watching it with, was like, oh, I have a copy of, like, Plan 9 from Outer Space on Laserdisc. Remember those kids?
Oh, wow.
Like, I think he was like, yeah, I have, like, a copy of Plan 9. Let's just watch Plan 9, because why not? So I think I have seen, like, part or parts of the movie Ed Wood. I don't entirely recall whether I've watched it from start to finish.
That's another great movie I would recommend. Yeah. I really like it. She's actually not, she doesn't have a big part. I mean, Ed Wood was married to one woman at the beginning of his life, and then another woman at the end of his life. She's the one at the end of life, but they don't give her a lot to do, which is unfortunate, but it's kind of the girlfriend role, but that's an amazing movie. But to get into technology, we were talking about this, I think, in the theater, because this is so weird to watch millennials and Gen Y audience look at, like, all this old technology that we remember. The camcorders, he takes out a phone that's like this big. Just videotapes is.
Yes. We were joking around, like, every time they pulled out a piece of, like, obsolete technology, we were like, hey, kids, this is called a VHS.
Yeah. And VHS was on the way out then. I think DVD was coming out at that time. But actually, VHS is making a big comeback. People are liking it. Cassettes, VHS, like every old technology is coming back now. But
Oh, yeah. Like, as somebody who does glitch art, like all of that CRT TV stuff and like running the lines through CRT so you can get some cool glitch effects, like, yeah. It's definitely.
I mean, when they use a payphone,
Yeah.
What else? What other obsolete technology did they do? It was like the videotape, and then and then there was the payphone, the
landline. There's a landline.
There's a landline. Yeah, that was. I think that was the first thing. It's like somebody called them on a landline.
Yeah, there's an old school camcorder. Obviously, you mentioned that already.
And the phone that Robert Blake pulls out, and it's like this big,
yeah, huge, like super OG cell phone.
It's like as big as this motor right here.
Right.
Oh, hello, yes.
Right.
How'd you get my house?
Yeah.
I had to read. Yeah. Anyway, but it's great for that old tech. And it's so weird. Like it seems like yesterday that I was in high school watching the movie for the first time, and now 25 mm-hmm. years later, and all the technology is obsolete. We're getting old.
Oh yeah.
but Richard Pryor's his last movie, and then when we saw it, Gary Busey comes on the screen, and this is before the allegations. I don't want to get into that, but the whole audience started laughing at Gary Busey.
Right.
Like literally, and he's completely serious in this movie, and I think does it. Yeah. I remember the first time I saw it, I said, he's the most normal character in the whole movie. He's like the only guy I can relate to. He's just a regular dad.
That's true. He's very, very straight man, very normal character in the movie. Yeah. And it's interesting because it's like
it's him and he's not normal.
I don't know that much about Gary Busey. I just know that. Well, I remember when he had a reality show with his son or something like that.
Yeah, he had on Comedy Central. So he just played up like that. He's crazy. What the thing about Gary Busey? Gary Busey, was a Star Is Born was like his big breakthrough, and then he did the Buddy Holly story. Was nominated for an Oscar. But he did a lot of movies in the '80s, and then I think in the late '80s, early '90s. He got in a motorcycle accident, did not have a helmet on.
Yes, I was aware of that. And I feel like following that, like he had a lot of behavioral changes that happened.
Yes. But he still, even after that, he still was, you know, he's Lethal Weapon, Point Break. He was still the Firm. He was still a good actor. And I don't know what caused David Lynch to cast it, but I think it's good casting in that he's such a weird, unstable guy. Playing a normal guy. It's just casting against type, and it's really good casting.
Yeah.
Richard Pryor at the time was in a wheelchair, had multiple sclerosis, really bad. I'm actually wearing my Richard Pryor shirt tonight.
Aww.
And you cheered when Richard Pryor came on.
Yeah.
And people, and you forgot he was in the movie.
I totally had forgotten that he was in the movie, but that was nice.
And he's only in the movie for a couple scenes, but I guess the second scene where he's talking on the phone was totally improv. And from the interview I saw with David Lynch, he said that, he didn't have anything written. He said, just go on the phone and we'll improv something. And I guess he went off for like 20 minutes and they cut that into the movie. So it was his last movie, Jack Nance and Robert Blake. And then and Balthazar Getty, like I said, I saw him in Natural War Killers. I saw him in this movie. I don't know what happened to him, but I guess I did look that up on Wikipedia. He's been in a lot of TV shows, but he never became a big star.
So like, okay, is he a Getty as in like rich people Gettys?
He's a Getty in like rich people Getty.
Okay. I was curious about that.
And the story is that, Oliver Stone theory aside, the official word is that David Lynch saw him in a magazine and said, that's him.
Interesting.
So, and he's, he's the fantasy guy. He's the fuck boy. And
yeah.
And the cops following him around every time he's having sex with all these girls.
Right. It's like, hilarious. He gets more pussy than a toilet seat.
Which I don't even get that line. I know he gets more ass than a toilet seat, but does the toilet seat get pussy? I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, I love those cops. I love the it's a 90s movie, so Henry Rollins has to be in it. So
yes,
but I think the guy that's the other prison guard that finds Balthazar Getty, and his delivery is hilarious to me.
Yeah, two characters are really funny.
Yeah.
I know it's not him, but at first I thought the other prison guard was Flea.
Would have been weird casting. And then, of course, you booed when Marilyn Manson made his brief appearance.
Yeah.
And which we're going to segue into the soundtrack now, because he's on the soundtrack.
Right.
His appearance and he's only in it for like 10 seconds as a porn star who apparently gets killed because it's a porn snuff film, which,
right.
You know, when you're jerking off, you really want to see somebody dying.
I think for that portion of the movie, David Lynch just went up to Marilyn Manson and was like, so what do you like to do in your free time?
Well, could be. And Twiggy's in there too. Twiggy Ramirez, yes. The bass player for Marilyn Manson, who was problematic himself, but yeah. Like I said, you didn't know about Robert Blake. I told you, and I didn't even want to get into Richard Pryor and Gary Busey because there's things I know that I don't know if you want to know. But
right.
Basically, everybody in this movie is problematic. And David Lynch has been married and divorced like 5 times. He's got 5 different. He and Richard Pryor have both have like 5 or 6 different children with 5 or 6 different women. David Lynch was married to the editor of Lost Highway at the time.
Interesting.
And divorced her, and yeah, he's got kids with 5 different. It seems like every decade he marries somebody new and has another child. So he's quite the fuckboy.
If you ever want to know my definition of a manther,
David Lynch is a manther.
That criteria probably qualifies.
Isn't he a grantor now?
Oh yeah, at this point in time, yeah.
But he's still knocking them out. So good for him. He's made more babies than movies in the last 20 years. But you just saw Nine Inch Nails in concert, and I saw the set list. It looked great. And
It was great actually. I got to see them twice. The first one was kind of like a short vacation that my partner and I planned for and saved up for. And we saw them at Red Rocks in Denver. It was excellent. And then shortly thereafter, what's that?
Red Rocks is a great place to see a concert. I lived in Denver, so I've been to Red Rocks. It's great.
Yeah, it was a very, very cool venue. Bit of a hike. For folks who have mobility things going on, it is. You definitely have to kind of be comfortably mobile. But yeah, and then once we came back, because I've been really active on the Nine Inch Nails Discord server, and there happened to be an individual. So I'll just say this: I'm not gonna like name anyone's real names or anything like that. But part of what has existed on the Nine Inch Nails Discord is there is a sub channel for sobriety support for people. And even though I'm not like officially a sober person, been through like the anonymous programs and stuff like that, I am somewhat trained in peer support techniques. So a while back, I ended up like hopping on that forum just to like, you know, help be supportive to folks. And a lot of folks also were like inspired by Trent Reznor's sobriety journey on there. So anyway, we have a group of us regulars who just kind of chat with each other on there. And one of the folks who's on that channel regularly DM'd me one day and was just like, hey, so like, I've got 2 pit tickets to the Santa Barbara Bowl show. And I was gonna sell them, but I'd rather give them away to like somebody who I know will appreciate them. And I was like, holy shit, are you serious? So this very generous person gifted my partner and I tickets to the Santa Barbara Bowl show that just happened. And that was the set list that you saw me post on social
media. That's great. And the irony being that person was Marilyn Manson. But no, of course not.
No, no.
But it's weird because I saw Nine Snails in 2018, but I also saw them at their quote-unquote final show in 2009.
Right. I have that t-shirt. Yeah, I actually have that t-shirt as well.
Were you there? Were you there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was
at that. I think it was called the Wave Goodbye Tour. But I think what ended up happening, I might be mistaken about this, but I think it was a point in time where, like, some folks were going in different directions. I know Trent was shifting gears, and, like, I think honestly at the time, this is just an assumption because he's a pretty private person, but I think at the time what was happening is, like, he was maybe deciding that he wanted to start a family at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he knew that the nature of his work was going to change or step back for a little bit.
He had a band with his wife.
Yeah.
He tried that, but I was up in a balcony, and it was weird. It was a weird crowd up the balcony because Penn Jillette was there with Ron Jeremy, and Tony Kanal from No Doubt was there, and I actually bumped fists with Eddie Van Halen.
Wow!
But he, you know, people didn't recognize him because he had short hair, and I was like, yeah, I gave him the horns. I was like, hey, Eddie, nice. And then so I bumped fists with him, and he's like, and somebody in the crowd's like, who's that? I'm like, that's Eddie Van Halen. He's like, that's Eddie Van Halen, because, you know, he didn't look the same.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I too, at an earlier Nine Inch Nails show, I think like maybe 1 or 2 years previous, I too have run into Ron Jeremy at a Nine Inch Nails show.
Right.
But, you know, not to give him a bunch of airtime right now, but that guy was definitely the man about town at like every fucking thing going on for a while in the LA area. Like, you were bound to run into him.
Sure. But my whole point is that show was like 3 hours, and they had so many guests, Gary Newman, Dillinger Escape Plan, all these. When I saw him in 2018, it was like, it was weird because it was a small show at the Hollywood Palladium.
Mm-hmm. We were at that one too. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm like getting pushed around, and it's like, it was like, you know, I don't know. After seeing the grand finale, it was just a little bit of a letdown, but this soundtrack is not a letdown, and that's a lot to do with Trent Reznor, beginning with the David Bowie song that begins and closes the movie, I'm Deranged, which I think is great.
Oh, yes. That's just like...
All secrets travel.
That is pretty much one of my favorite more recent Bowie songs. And it is the album that I believe that's from, if I'm not mistaken, which was called Outside. I think it was on the Outside album. Like, that was one of those ones that was hugely monumentally inspiring for Trent Reznor. And Nine Inch Nails actually has a song called God Break Down the Door that, mm-hmm. like, you can clearly hear the continuous line from that particular era of Bowie to this somewhat more recent song of Nine Inch Nails. Like, it's clearly just kind of like a tribute song, and it's beautiful. And
well, they toured together around this time too, Nine Inch Nails and David Bowie.
Oh yeah.
And I'll be honest, I've seen if you ever see David Bowie singing Hurts with Nine Inch Nails,
mm-hmm.
it makes Johnny Cash's verses sound like a piece of shit. I gotta be honest in comparison, but you know, that's just me.
I think that the Bowie Nine Inch Nails tour was, if I'm not mistaken, my very first time seeing Nine Inch Nails. I might have been in like eighth grade at the time or something like that.
Yeah, you were really young. I was.
But holy shit, like that, I would consider that, it was the Great Western Forum. That was one of like the all-time best concerts of my existence.
Now let me ask you, since we're talking about Bowie, who, by the way, is the last cool white man there ever has been. I can't think of a cool white man now since he died. Like, everybody, like, if he walks into any room, people are like, okay, that dude's cool. Just effortlessly. Like, Johnny Depp was cool at one time. He's not cool anymore. There's other people that were cool at one time. They're not cool anymore. David Bowie was always cool. But the Nine Inch Nails David Bowie tour, David Bowie fans were disappointed because he didn't do, like, Let's Dance and all the hits.
You're talking about the...
When he toured Nine Inch Nails?
Yeah. No, he didn't. He was doing it more to support, I think, newer material of his, if I remember correctly. So during that time, it was, during that time, it was both that Outside album, which was very kind of like experimental jazz influence.
Which I've never heard. Is it good?
Please go listen to it.
All right.
It's like performance art jazz. Like it's a concept album and it has a plot line. It's fucking cool. Like,
All right. I highly recommend. Love On the Range, but I've never listened to the album.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. And then I think, I don't know that Earthling was out yet, but what came out immediately after that tour with the two of them, which is, I believe, close to the era when I'm Afraid of Americans collab came out, was Bowie trying to take more of like a drum and bass, like breakbeats kind of approach to his music. So he was kind of like hopping on that bandwagon.
But I remember Earthling. I've heard that.
Yeah, I personally enjoyed that album as well. But yeah.
And and now, did Nine Inch Nails do The Perfect Drug when you saw them?
They did The Perfect Drug at Santa Barbara. They didn't do it at Red Rocks.
All right.
Yeah, they're making, on this tour, they are making an effort to really change it up. They have some anchor songs every night. Like, Hurt is definitely closing every night. And what they do with the lighting setup for Hurt is just, like, beautiful. But they are really trying to change it up every show, which I think is great.
Well, I was envious because I saw the track list and there was a lot of Fragile material on there, and that's my favorite.
Yeah, at the Santa Barbara show, they did a really decent chunk of songs from Broken through the Fragile, and that's, you know, that's the peak of their work in a lot of ways, and I really appreciated that. Fragile is like one of my faves. So,
and you know, another song that I really like is probably, I would say, if it's not my favorite Smashing Pumpkins song, it's in the top five, is I.
Yeah, it's definitely like iconic. Like, when I think back to that late 90s era, I think of that song. But I also like it because for the Pumpkins, it was very like goth and synth. And it kind of was this like doorway into, I believe not long after that, they made a much more synthy album.
Right. Well, when they were big, Siamese Dream, Melancholy, and they were all over radio and MTV, and I was, I think just getting into high school, I wasn't into them. I didn't get it. When Adore came out, which was the album right after this that you're talking about, then I got into them a little bit. And really, after they broke up, I started listening to the old albums, and I'm like, it's really good.
Yeah.
So, Adore, Ava Adore sounds almost like I, but I think I was good. And I don't know if Trent had any hand in that song, but it kind of sounds like he could have. I mean, it sort of has an industrial sort of thing. And I've heard I in goth clubs, by the way.
So have I.
They throw that out.
So have I.
They throw that out, but it's a lot of people's favorite Smashing Pumpkins songs. I know a lot of people that like that song that don't like them, but they like that one. Mm-hmm. This Magic Moment by Lou Reed, I'm not a Lou Reed fan, but it does fit that scene.
It was a good choice for that particular scene. And I do actually like Lou Reed's music. I thought that was a nice pick as well.
I don't hate it, but I've never been a huge. I like some Velvet Underground, but solo Lou Reed, I've never gotten into. But and then you get to the Apple of Sodom by Marilyn Manson, which I actually think is a good song. Putting aside Marilyn Manson, but and once again,
I won't disagree with you. Like,
it's a low key song for him too,
right? Like, all of the drama aside, just looking at the music, I actually tend to agree with you.
And it fits the scene. And by the way, the Smashing Pumpkins song is them going into a bowling alley, and I've never been to a bowling alley where they played but and also Marilyn Manson's I Put a Spell on You fits that scene too.
Yeah, it
is a creepy version of that song. There's another song, and I think it's Something Wicked That This Way Comes, where they they scratch in it's the one at the party that fades out when
yes
Blake's there.
Barry Adamson.
Yes, it's it's like some old 60s song that they sort of sort of remix and it's strange. Yeah. And then it fades out and fades back in. And the other thing about the soundtrack, and I remember at the time, this was a real wake up call. Was first time I ever heard Rammstein was on the Lost Highway soundtrack.
Yes.
And it was really like,
yes,
I really became a fan right away. And I remember this is pre-Du Hast.
I definitely think that like Rammstein, the song that they picked, like it's its own character in the movie. like it's its own character in the movie. It is completely intrusive.
Oh, absolutely. It's the scene where he's all disoriented and he goes and this is, yeah, it's so weird. But in 1997, I never heard anything quite like it.
Yeah,
and then at the time they were nothing, and then Du Hast came out, and now they're playing stadiums. So, the other song that is not on the soundtrack but is very featured in the movie. Now, this is what the 4K thing. I didn't think added anything. I didn't see anything that was that clear, and I think some of it was grainy too. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was like I wasn't wowed by the visuals in the 4K, but you know I'm like. I'm always somebody that's suspect of technology anyway, and I don't have a Blu-ray player. DVD's fine for me. Mm-hmm. But the sound was definitely enhanced, and it's to the point that I did not remember all the times I've seen this movie before that they played Song to the Siren by This Mortal Coil. The first time they make love, and Fred has impotence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then they bring it back around. I remember at the end when Balthazar Getty and her are getting it on, and do you want me? And mm-hmm. I want to, and you'll never have me. So it was really jarring to hear that.
Yeah, I did not recall that either. I mean,
it's very faint too.
Huh?
It was very faint too.
Yeah. That's one of those like Baron Stain moments that was
this is the Mandela effect. Yeah.
It was
a very Mandela effect, but I think it was buried in the original mix and is back on now. This is we can talk all night about this, but we're going to wrap it up a little bit. But I did want to say this was on VHS, you know, which was the technology at the time, but it didn't get released on DVD for like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I always wanted to get a DVD, they didn't have it. I remember I was in Canada, and they had a DVD in Canada.
Right, you told me about that.
And I actually, I so wanted this on DVD, I ordered a copy on eBay that was like a South Korean copy, but uh-huh. played in American DVD players. And then when I ordered that, literally like 6 months later, they released it on DVD.
Interesting. Yeah, and now that you mention that and that whole process of like how long it took them to release on DVD, I'm thinking back because funny enough, when I like went and rewatched it recently, I was like, oh my God, I could have swore I like actually had a DVD copy of this movie. I think my copy of it is on VHS.
Mm-hmm.
Not totally sure where that is, but now that you mentioned that whole process that it took.
I see CDs other old media behind you, so I don't know. It could be somewhere.
Yeah. Well, those aren't mine, but yeah. I still have all my, I have my old stuff, and I do have a few VHSs. I still have the VHS tape recording of like the MTV news that announced Kurt Cobain's suicide.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, that's somewhere in my collection. I gotta look for it, but yeah. And some old Beavis and Butthead tapes.
See, we're back in the 90s. It was would you agree with me? And I've had a couple people say this, the 90s were really the last definitive decade.
The last what? That
definitive decade where you can say, oh yeah, that's 90s.
And
it went through a lot of changes.
The only pushback against that I would give is like, I think the last real like movement or aesthetic we had was maybe in the early 2000s, like emo and scene kids having like a mainstream moment. Like, that was kind of a moment that was post 90s. I'm not saying it was good necessarily.
But emo and scene kids were just like kind of like popular goths. Like they yeah. wanted to go goth, but they couldn't quite go that far. They tried right. to make like garage rock a thing, and that didn't work. That didn't stick.
Right, like the hipster, like garage, yeah, neo garage rock kind of.
But even like emo and garage rock and all that still harken back to older movements. You know, it sort of was like, but I don't know. I just and I went to a 2000s club recently, and it was very strange.
And yeah, I'm still too scared to like.
It's hard to dance to My Chemical Romance, but you know people were doing it. But it's hard to. And we're still stuck in the 80s. Like the 90s, there's still some 90s nostalgia, but it's still, we're going back to the 80s.
Yeah.
But
now we're going back, I think because of like Stranger Things, now we're going back to like early to mid 80s nostalgia, like full blown mullets are back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Yeah. Who doesn't like a mullet? Well, I mean, that's the thing. You got. If Kate Bush has the number one song, and that's a good thing, you got to get the ball back.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Yeah. I love all the 80s music.
Yeah. Right. So The Lost Highway. So my interpretation is, and it took me a long time to figure it out, is that he did kill her. And the other, another thing I saw recently that I didn't notice was all the videotapes. They're not taped like a guy holding a videotape. They're all from above. The videotapes of him killing his wife are all from above, which is strange. Which mm-hmm. also begs the question, is Robert Blake God? Maybe. So, but my interpretation is that, but if he was God, he'd be in another movie since 1997. But, my interpretation is that, so he's a guy that is in a marriage that's falling apart, and I've never been in a relationship that's been gone on long enough that I've, you know, been in those doldrums, but I know a lot of people will have, and I don't really know why he kills her, if that's not really explained, but he kills her, he goes to prison, and then the second half of the movie where he turns into Balthazar Garrigetti is, you know, his idyllic life while he's waiting for the electric chair. And then at the end, when his head's shaking, he's dying.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the other thing, but that now that you talked about it, I'm like thinking of, see, I always come up with new interpretations. Now that you talked about it, you're like, well, are they all the same person? Is Balthazar Getty, Bill Pullman, and Robert Loggia, who I didn't even talk about, but he's great. Are they the same person? He goes in and says Dick LaRance is dead. Is he Dick LaRance?
Is the mystery man Dick
is
LaRance?
Bill, is Bill Pullman Dick LaRance?
Oh, okay. I mean, my understanding was that Mr. Eddie was AKA Dick LaRance.
Right.
Because they only start to say that like after they specifically like show them killing off Mr. Eddie.
Right.
But
so
yeah.
So him going and the whole Dick LaRance is dead thing actually happened to David Lynch. Somebody went to his intercom, said Dick LaRance is dead. He went to the door, nobody was there.
That's creepy.
Yeah, so and I guess he was neighbors with the actor David Lander, who played Squiggy on Laverne and Shirley.
Mm-hmm.
His name was David, so he thinks somebody was actually trying to tell Squiggy that Dick LaRance is dead. So I don't know.
Interesting.
But I will tell you, I mean, regardless of interpretation, this is one of my favorite movies, and it was great to see it on the big screen again. And,
yeah, I really enjoyed that.
I was actually, before you posted it, I was going to go to Glendale to see it. Because they had released it like the month before in Glendale. Uh-huh. And then I'm glad I got to see it with somebody. I got to see it with a Gen Y crowd that was laughing at Gary Busey and befuddled by some of, they were laughing at some weird, inappropriate parts.
And also
befuddled by the technology. I'm trying to think what other thing they were laughing at that wasn't supposed to be funny, but it was weird, yeah. And the theater that we saw it in, the Los Feliz 3, which is two blocks from here, was built in 1934, so it was a good theater to see it in, mm-hmm. even though our seats weren't the best, but they were good enough. What are your last thoughts on Lost Highway?
I personally would say, like, actually, this is kind of my attitude towards all of David Lynch, is like, don't analyze it too hard, just be in the art of it. And hey, it's fun to like have these theories about the plot line and who the characters are, but I feel like with David Lynch, it's also just more of a flavor. Like you're chewing on these flavors of David Lynch being David Lynch. And it's really funny because actually before I reached out to you, or you and I chatted about you, coming to see the movie with me, I reached out to another friend of mine who's slightly older, like I guess you could say that they're in the Gen X category, mm-hmm. and they're a huge film buff, like really, really like could tell you the plot lines of this, that, and the other. I don't know if they have like academic background in it or whatever, but anyway, like I reached out and I was like, hey, would you like to see this? And they said no, because they're like, you know, as much of a David Lynch fan as I am, I feel like in that movie, he's just like David Lynch trying to do David Lynch. Like,
that's a lot of people say that. And it's interesting that Mulholland Drive, which is very similar.
Yeah.
His next movie was so, so overpraised. I don't know about overpraised. I like it, but
yeah,
it was like nominated for Oscars. Every critic.
Right.
Roger Ebert never gave him any good review until Mulholland Drive and said it was like the best movie of the year.
Yeah.
And to me, they're very similar movies.
Agreed, yeah.
And both good, but there's something about Lost Highway. As I told you, Mulholland Drive is easier to explain for me. And the last thing I'm going to say, and then I'll let you plug what you want, but the last thing I want to say is that even though I love David Lynch movies, I think this may be why I love David Lynch movies, is I don't remember my dreams a lot. So when he has these weird dream sequences and these weird, like, I think because I don't dream like that myself. I very rarely do I remember a dream when I wake up. And when I do, it is scattered. But do you dream like that?
Very rarely these days. I feel like I used to maybe more in the past, but very rarely. Yeah, I don't remember as much these days. So yeah, I mean, that goes back to what I was saying about, it's really about the aesthetic with a lot of what David Lynch does. And I feel like with this movie in particular, with Lost Highway, like it was very much a pop culture moment, just like with that convergence of the people, like the actors in the movie, how the soundtrack was curated and all of that. Like, it was just like, it was a peak 90s moment, in my opinion.
If you talk about 1997, this is it.
Yeah.
And well, thank you for being on. Anything you want to plug, please plug. Let the people want to know what you got going on and how to see your glitch art and all that.
So my collab with my partner is MMIX_art on Instagram. We also specifically for that collab work have a Patreon that you can support, and it's like all the links are in the bio there and everything like that. I do perform solo as well. I've been doing stand-up this year, so you can find me at LL Font on my own solo Instagram. And yeah, that's pretty much okay. It. All my links are in my like bio things on all the places. So,
well, it's always a delight to talk to you, and I'm glad we got to finally really talk about this movie at length, because it's one of my favorites, and I can't really explain why, but it is.
Agreed. Yeah, this is definitely not just one of my faves, but I'm a big Lynch fan, and definitely, like you were saying, like peak mid-90s pop culture moment, in my opinion.
So thanks for being on, and I am Goth Comedian on all social media. Everybody, have a wonderfully creepy week. Bye.
Thank you so much, Dark Mark. Good night, thanks. Everybody. Night. Bye.